The topic of today's lecture is entrepreneurship, and it's the third of five podcasts on that topic. All five podcasts are going to revolve around the question of how entrepreneurship impacts the economy. Our focus in this lecture is the paper, When Does Startup Innovation Spur the Gale of Creative Destruction? Written by Joshua Gantz, David Chu, and Scott Stern, and published in the Rand Journal of Economics in 2002. Already from the title of the paper, it's pretty clear what the paper is about. It's about when, or better, under what conditions, does entrepreneurship actually contribute to creative destruction? And by implication, when does it not? That, at the outset, is going to be a challenge to Schumpeter's view, because it suggests that entrepreneurship might not upset established market positions, even if it's wildly successful. You would, of course, imagine that entrepreneurship might fail to do that because entrepreneurs might not succeed. We'll return to that lack of success in the next two podcasts. But basically, you might imagine that failing entrepreneurship might fail to bring about creative destruction because, for instance, entrepreneurs lack the ability to execute their dramatic visions. Schumpeter's entrepreneur is not a heroic figure for nothing. It is very hard to spur the gale of creative destruction. But that is not what Gantz and his colleagues are after. Rather, they're exploring the conditions under which entrepreneurs might choose to reinforce rather than challenge their market power of incumbents. They might choose to not bring about creative destruction, but to contribute to warding off its effects on incumbents by making incumbents better able to compete. Now, that might sound a little bit esoteric, but here's sort of a summary of the idea. In a lot of consumer electronic fields, startups often engage in head-on competition with incumbents. And to quote the paper, they're earning their innovation rents through product market entry and competition with more established firms. End of quote. Now, by contrast, in biotechnology, quote, cooperation between startup innovators and more established firms is the norm. End of quote. Now, cooperation is a word to watch for here. A startup can, well, start up with no intention of competing with incumbents, but effectively seek to become a technology supplier to those incumbents, and thus make incumbents able to launch new products, which, as you know, they have good reasons to struggle to do so normally. An entrepreneur can in this way seek to contribute to the networked ambidexterity of an incumbent, fulfilling their explorative function. The kind of explorative function that exploitatively oriented incumbents may struggle with. And this could happen in any number of ways. They might license out their technology to incumbents, they may engage in strategic alliances, or they might deliberately just seek to get acquired. But now, why would a startup want to do that, you might say? Why not take on the incumbent? Why not shake up the world and be the hero of Schumpeter's story? Well, consider the somewhat simplistic case where you have identified a new drug. Right? It might be a fantastic drug, one with incredible value. Once you have that, do you then try to find the millions or billions of euro that you'll actually need to get it approved for sale and bet on your own ability to set up an efficient production system to manufacture it once you've gotten the approval? Or do you do the altogether more simple thing and sell your invention to a big pharmaceutical company, take the money and do something better with your time, while that company brings your invention to market? Or, as a sort of more banal example, consider that you've invented the most superlative windshield wiper in history. Do you then try to build an automotive company differentiated from the competition primarily by the excellence of its windshield wiping? Or do you take out a patent on your invention and let Ford or some other company try to differentiate the cars that they already make a little bit along that axis of improvement? Now, you might reasonably decide to patent and license your technology to Ford, right? And if you want to know how the true story of that deal actually played out, you can and should watch the movie Flash of Genius, released in 2008, about Robert Kearns' invention of the intermittent windshield wiper and his struggle with Ford once he tried to license it to them. It's way more interesting than I just made it sound, I should say. Now, Gantz and his colleagues are trying to suss out when startups choose strategies that respectively focus on competition and focus on collaboration. Why is it that consumer electronics are filled with competition and biotech is filled with collaboration? More generally put, what conditions lead entrepreneurs to adopt one or the other, to find one or the other more viable as the basis for their strategy? And their focus here is on the workings of the market for ideas. We talk about the market for ideas also in our discussions of the future of innovation management. As it turns out, a well-functioning market for ideas makes collaboration much more likely, meaning that in the presence of a well-functioning market for ideas, startups contribute less to creative destruction. The Schumpeterian entrepreneur, in other words, becomes a hero mainly because of shortcomings in the markets for ideas. But let's back up from that a little bit. For one, it's worth saying that we'll go into considerably more detail on what exactly a market for technologies, or for ideas more broadly, is when we, in the discussion of the future of innovation management. A well-functioning market for technology has implications for startups and technology-leading incumbents and technology-lacking incumbents, all of whom see an expansion of their strategic opportunities when technologies can be efficiently traded. For now, we'll confine our focus to what a well-functioning market means for entrepreneurial strategy, and more specifically, the choice between cooperation and competition with incumbents. Now, a startup faces numerous threats from incumbents, right? Most notably that whatever innovations the entrepreneurs develop, incumbents can try to reverse engineer the innovation or develop competing innovations. Then it's reasonable to suppose the incumbent can leverage economies of scale and assets already controlled to offer that innovation cheaply to the market and squeeze out the aspiring competition. You could even underprice your introduction of the innovation to the market just to deter competition from entering. And that in and of itself makes it reasonable for a budding entrepreneur to want to collaborate, because that reduces the already considerable risk involved in an entrepreneurial venture. If you had a great idea for a search engine, do you try to get acquired by Google, or do you try to take on Google? That's sort of a question of boldness, right? But of course, cooperating is not without its own risks. Just telling an incumbent about the innovation can, in what is known in economics as Arrow's paradox, be enough for them to begin engineering a solution. Once you know that an intermittent windshield wiper can be made, a company like Ford can put a small army of engineers to work developing that precise solution, and they can often do so quickly. The idiosyncratic insight, as we know from Kurtzner and Shane, is really a non-trivial part of the innovation. And the incumbent might simply not have thought of the possibility, or might not have prioritized it, as we talked about when we talked about the management of innovation processes. In both cases, the entrepreneur faces what's called a threat of expropriation, of having their idea metaphorically stolen, such that it loses all value to them. It is, on the face of it, a bit of a toss-up then between collaborating and competing. However, in the presence of strong intellectual property rights, which we'll call IP from here on out, it's less of a toss-up because the entrepreneur can exclude the incumbent from stealing their idea. That's what intellectual property does. It turns an idea into something that you can exclusively own. A patent is a temporary government-enforced monopoly granted to the patentee in exchange for revealing the invention. It rewards an innovator for putting an idea in the public domain, and the reward is that they have an exclusive right to use the idea for a set period, as opposed to keeping the idea a trade secret. This exclusive right means that an entrepreneur is positioned more strongly to compete against the incumbent should they choose to do so. The entrepreneur with a strong patent is a more threatening potential competitor, and therefore the incumbent may be willing in principle to pay the entrepreneur to collaborate and be willing to pay more. Moreover, collaborating is easier once a patent exists, because this is functionally a technical recipe for the innovation, and so it's easy and therefore cheaper to transfer, which is really good for both parties. And that's what leads Gantz and his colleagues to their first proposition, that strong IP makes collaboration strategies more likely and more valuable. But all is not well simply by having a clearly defined, legally well-protected idea. As we know, there's fundamental uncertainty about the value of innovations, such as the nature, as per March, of innovation. So something that might reduce the uncertainty would, in principle, increase the value of collaboration for an incumbent, making collaboration more valuable for the entrepreneur. This leads to the second proposition, that having brokers or other intermediaries that can validate the value of an idea make collaboration more likely. But even then, given strong IP and brokers who can vouch for the value under uncertain conditions, entrepreneurs may also be pushed into collaboration simply by the looming specter of having to compete with an incumbent. If you collaborate with an incumbent, you can leverage the assets that they already have sunk capital into developing. If you compete, you have to build those assets, which is why you wouldn't choose to challenge Ford simply on account of having a better windshield wiper. You can basically only choose to collaborate. There's way too much to do to compete. But that may vary very much between industries, and some industries may require many more assets than others to get into business. When you can start a dot-com company in your parents' basement or their garage, you might as well give competition with that titanic incumbent a shot. And that leads to the third proposition. The costlier it is to enter the market, the more likely the choice of collaboration. So how do Gantz and his colleagues go about testing these propositions? After all, most of the things they're interested in aren't exactly something that you pull out of a public database. So what they do instead is that they survey 118 young companies that have either received venture capital funding or a government R&D grant. To get at their dependent variable, they measure whether firms earned revenue through licensing their technology or whether firms got acquired by, one would infer, an incumbent. In either case, they count as cooperating. Otherwise, they're competing. Now, to get at the first independent variable, namely strength of IP, they measure the strength by looking at whether a firm has patents and how they rate, using the good old Likert scale, the importance of patents and secrecy relative to each other. The presence of intermediaries is taken care of by their sampling method, where they included firms with VC money and count them as having intermediaries, assuming that venture capitalists can function as intermediaries that guarantee incumbents a value of an idea. Whereas if you get a government R&D grant, you count as not having an intermediary. Now, I'm not super comfortable with this approach, I should say. I mean, you can, as a general dynamic, imagine a firm getting venture capital without that venture capitalist being super deep in the weeds of a particular industry. And you can certainly imagine that that not all venture capitalists have long-term relationships with incumbents that allow them to negotiate effectively. That may often be the case, but it's probably not always the case. And finally, for the cost of entry variable, they again rely on Likert scales and, as one of course should, interviewed respondents as well to make sure that they understood the questions and scales in a meaningful way. And then they create two variables of that, one to assess whether the incumbent assets are generally important and want to assess whether one specific class of incumbent assets are important. And that, I think, is really quite meaningful given how very, very difficult it actually is to measure something like that. Their analysis then proceeds, and they attend to those red flag issues that you might expect to come up. One big one is that some of the independent variables might actually be dependent on the dependent variable. You might say that choosing a cooperation strategy is more likely if you have strong patents and venture capitalists to broker your negotiations. But you might also have patents and venture capitalists because you want to cooperate. That's what they describe as endogeneity, and the controls for that are sensible enough, but ultimately are hard to deal with because they observe the strategy as a cooperative one only once cooperation has been achieved, i.e. that the strategy is successful, which of course it doesn't need to be, right? You could imagine an entrepreneur getting strong patents to exclude competition and then getting venture capital backing to navigate competition in that industry, but then getting bought up by an incumbent that they had every intention of competing with because that incumbent thought that they were a threat and were better bought up. Or the entrepreneur might simply have believed that the best way to actually get acquired was to actually be a competitive threat. Now, another of those important red flag issues is that entrepreneurial quality simply differs and that it's very hard to observe the underlying quality of a startup in this data. Getting patents and getting VC funding might be associated with just having better projects, and better projects may be more likely to result in acquisitions. There's a lot to say for this, and the baseline is that it's hard, and they have meaningful arguments for why what they do is reasonable and perhaps even a little bit conservative. All in all, they find, which is never all that surprising, sort of in the style of the academic paper, that their propositions hold up, although not with incredibly strong and significant effects. And they can therefore conclude, with all the caveats of studying complex phenomena, and I quote, "In economic environments such as those observed in the biotechnology industry, where patents are relatively effective in protecting intellectual property rights, firms face high relative investment costs and brokers are available to facilitate trade. Startup innovators tend to earn their returns from innovation through the market for ideas, acting as an upstream supplier of technology rather than as a horizontal, innovation-oriented competitor. In contrast, when investment costs for the entrant are relatively low, and the technological innovation is not protected by patents, as in the disk drive industry, the severe disclosure threat tends to foreclose the ideas market. Startup innovators in this environment are more likely to commercialize their innovations through product market competition." End of quote. In other words, having a well-functioning system for trading in technologies makes it much more likely that entrepreneurs cooperate with incumbents rather than confront them in competition. Now, I'll leave you to think about whether, as we'll talk about next time, it's then good or bad for the economy as a whole that the markets for technology are getting more prevalent and functioning better. This is, of course, really, really complex discussion and very contingent on the competitive forces otherwise at work in an industry. But it's interesting to contemplate nonetheless. What I would like to talk about is the way that Gantz and Stern have further developed upon the idea of this paper into the notion of entrepreneurial strategy as a choice generally between cooperation and competition. In later work, and here I'm referring to the 2017 paper, Endogenous Appropriability, and the 2019 paper, Control versus Execution, that they wrote with Kenny Ching, Gantz and Stern suggested that entrepreneurs also face another choice, namely the choice of whether to invest in control over their innovations or through execution. Control basically means to pursue a strategy of excluding competition, or in strategy parlance, building a moat around their ideas such that competitors cannot copy them. Now, you can do that by having strong IP, of course, but also by investing in secrecy such that you also cannot be copied by competitors. An execution, by contrast, means that companies invest in building first-mover advantages, as we discussed in relation to Lieberman and Montgomery's paper by that name. In that case, you're not necessarily trying to build a moat as much as you're trying to storm ahead and hope that others will struggle to keep up. Now, if you use those two dimensions, competition versus collaboration and control versus execution, to create a 2x2 model, you get four potential outcomes. You get competition through control, competition through execution, collaboration through control, and collaboration through execution. And that framework is essentially the framework that the two authors elaborate in the recent book, Entrepreneurial Strategy, and that they summarize in the Harvard Business Review paper, Strategy for Startups, and formalize somewhat in the Foundations of Entrepreneurial Strategy. Now, this work considers or posits that entrepreneurs should always think about at least four paths to creating value for their idea. You can imagine a version where the entrepreneurs compete through execution. That's what they refer to as a disruption strategy. You're focused on capturing overlooked markets and aggressively scaling up to challenge industry incumbents. You can imagine a version where you, diametrically opposed to this, collaborate through control. That's an intellectual property strategy of securing strong patents and other protections for your idea before transferring it to incumbents. But you could also imagine competing through control. That'd be sort of the classic competitive strategy of Michael Porter, where you compete by trying to exclude competition, where you build a moat around your ideas to prevent competitors from copying it. Or you could collaborate through execution, where you partner with incumbents to strengthen their value chains and aggressively invest in scaling up to become the preferred provider of a very narrow service. In the work that Gantz and Stern have done around this, they raised a slightly provocative idea that all entrepreneurial ideas could in principle be realized through all four ideal typical strategies. And I definitely second their suggestion that all entrepreneurs, at the very least, think through what would our strategy look like in each of these four forms to bolster what I like to call the entrepreneurial imagination and expand the range of strategic options that they can identify. Now, in that work, aside from developing these four archetypical or ideal typical strategies, they also present the entrepreneurs essentially engaged in a process of hypothesis development and hypothesis testing. All new ventures before the entrepreneurs act on them are ideas about a possible future state of affairs. And to turn an idea into an actual venture, entrepreneurs have hypotheses, educated guesses and strong intuitions, but never certainty, about that idea's potential value and their own ability to realize that value. In Kurtzner's terms, they've recognized an opportunity that is not yet commonly recognized. And as they pursue value realization, they're essentially acting on an emerging theory, a set of beliefs about the world that are forming based on the confrontation of the initial hypothesis with the data. How customers respond, what turns out to be technologically feasible, what they themselves are capable of, etc. Once their idea has been realized, it's no longer a hypothesis, it's a theory, and in Kurtzner's terms, market ignorance has been reduced by the demonstration of the theory's veracity. Now, in itself, this can seem like a little bit of a word game and a labeling exercise. However, I think the implication of thinking about entrepreneurs as theorists is brought home very well in a recent paper called A Scientific Approach to Entrepreneurial Decision-Making by Arnaldo Camufo and his colleagues at Bocconi University, published in Management Science in 2020. Thinking of entrepreneurs as theorists also means engaging in experimentation that's not only meant to produce learning, but also meant to disprove the underlying hypothesis. And ultimately, ultimately hopefully supporting people in abandoning ideas that cannot be backed up by data. Interestingly enough, they find that exposing entrepreneurs to ideas about rigorous hypothesis testing makes them perform better, but they do better primarily because they're better at exposing themselves to negative feedback. Interpreting negative market signals as cues to revise their theories and abandoning those theories that do not hold up. That kind of disciplined thinking is, I think, tremendously valuable in a space such as entrepreneurship that is wrapped up in romance and all kinds of advice from just do it, stick with your dreams, take the leap, etc., etc. If indeed, as some entrepreneurship gurus suggest, you should only ever pursue ideas that nobody else believes in, it's probably very good to have a baseline understanding of what kind of data would lead you personally to recognize that everybody else is indeed right and you are wrong. You won't, after all, be spurring the gale of creative destruction very much with a crappy idea. And indeed, most entrepreneurial ideas, as we'll now get to, aren't very good.